This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars Aftermath, Life Debt, Book 2 of the Aftermath Trilogy, by Chuck Wendig. Read for you by Mark Thompson.
The Empire is in chaos. As the old order crumbles, the fledgling New Republic seeks a swift end to the galactic conflict. Many Imperial leaders have fled from their posts, hoping to escape justice in the farthest corners of known space. Pursuing these Imperial deserters are Nora Wexley and her team of unlikely allies. As more and more officers are arrested, planets once crushed beneath the Empire's heel now have hope for the future. And no hope is greater than that of the Wookiees of Kashyyyk. Heroes of the Rebellion, Han Solo and Chewbacca, have gathered a team of smugglers and scoundrels to free Kashyyyk from its Imperial slavers once and for all. Meanwhile, the remnants of the Empire, now under the control of Grand Admiral Rey Sloan and her powerful secret advisor, prepare to unleash a terrifying counterstrike. If successful, the New Republic may never recover, and anarchy will be loosed upon the galaxy in its greatest time of need.
Prelude. Jakku, 3 decades ago. The boy runs. His footsteps echo across the hard, unforgiving ground. His feet have no shoes. They are wrapped in ratty bindings, the same bindings Mirsa Topol uses to mend the wounds of those miners and scavengers who come to the anchorite nurse for succor. As such, the ground is rough beneath him. It bites through the thin cloth. It abrades. But he does not bleed, because his feet are tough, even if many think him weak. Clouds of dust kick up with every step. Scree hisses across rock. The boy is chasing something. A pair of streaking contrails bisecting the dead sky. It comes from a ship that flew overhead. A strange ship, like he had never seen. It gleamed black. Clean, like shined polished glass. He was out scrubbing solar arrays when he saw it pass overhead. One of the other orphan boys, Brev, said,
"Look at the pretty ship, Gally."
Narwhal, the girl with one dead eye, drew back her cracked and bleeding lips, responding with,
"It won't stay pretty for long. Nothing stays pretty here."
That, she says with some authority.
The boy had to see. He had to see the pretty ship before Jakku ruined it. Before the stone wind scoured its hull. Before the sun baked off its color. Anchorite Kolob told him to stay behind, finish his chores. But the boy would have none of that. He was compelled, as if by destiny. He ran, for one click, then another, until his legs ached so hard they felt like clumps of cured dried meat hanging from his hips. But now, here he is, atop the plaintive hand plateau, an outcropping of bent flat rock that the anchorites say is a holy place, a place the consecrated Eremite considered home thousands of years before, when Jakku was supposedly a verdant living place. Out there, down in the valley, he spies the ship. Sun trapped in its perfect steel, the bright and blinding bands stark even in the light of day. He thinks, "I could stop here." In fact, he should stop here. The boy knows he should turn tail and go home. Back to the Habit House. Back to his work
and his contemplations and to the other orphans. And yet, he remains compelled, as if something invisible is tugging him along, an unseen thread bound to his throat, leading him like a leash and collar.
I will get a little closer. I won't be missed.
The boy creeps down the narrow switchback path leading into the valley. At the bottom, all that separates him from the ship are dozens of rocky outcroppings, spires of crooked red stone jutting up out of the sand like broken, bloody teeth. He moves from stone to stone, hiding behind each, trying to stay silent. Silent like the skitter mice that cross the desert when night falls and the ground cools. The ship roams into view. This is a ship that does not belong here. A dark mirror, long and lean, with swept-back wings and crimson windows. It sits as silent and as patient as a perching raptor, like the vicious Vorka, the birds that swoop and eat the little skitter mice. The boy scurries from stone to stone until he is close. Close enough to smell the ozone coming off it. Close enough to feel the warmth of the sun radiating from its hull. A heat haze rises above it, warping the air. Nothing moves. No sound comes from inside.
I have seen enough. I should go.
The boy remains rooted, despite this thought. Finally, a shudder and a hiss. A ramp descends from the ship's smooth underbelly. Vapor gases off into the heated air. A figure eases down the ramp. The boy almost laughs. This someone must certainly be lost, given the way that he is dressed. A long, purple cloak drags behind him. A tall hat sits poised upon the man's head. Then the boy thinks, some of the anchorites wear heavy robes like this, don't they? They say it tests them. It is sacred to learn how to withstand the heat. It is necessary, they say, to shun pain and learn to live beyond its margins. Maybe this man is an anchorite. Though the anchorites avoid pretty precious things, don't they? No material entanglements, they say. This ship, the boy believes, certainly qualifies as a material entanglement. As to the droids that follow swiftly thereafter, 6 of them, each upright on legs shining like black, sun-blasted glass. Antennas rise from insectile heads, and the man in the purple robe waves them on without a word. Mouthpieces vocalize a series of tones and clicks just before they step out onto the hard, sand-scoured rock. The boy watches as they place down black boxes, boxes that connect to one another with beams of green light, beams bright enough to see even in the day, beams that connect to one another and form a kind of frame. The man eases slowly down the ramp, his cloak whispering against the metal like sand blown across sheets of tin.
This is it. This is the space. Mark it and begin excavation. I will return.
One of the droids says,
Yes, Advisor Tashu.
There is a moment when the boy realizes that an opportunity has presented itself. He hates this world. He does not belong here. As the man in the purple robe returns up the ramp, he thinks,
This is my chance. My chance to leave this place and never return.
For a moment he is frozen, paralyzed by indecision, affixed by the fear of uncertainty. He has no idea where the ship will go, or who that man is, or what they will do if they find him. But he knows this place is dead. The ramp begins to rise, and the boy, Galley, thinks,
I must hurry.
And hurry he does. Fast and quiet, like the skitter mice, He bounds across the sand in his bare feet and catches the lip of the ramp as it closes. Gally tucks his body up and in, crawling into the dark moments before the ship begins to take off.
Part 1. Chapter 1.
Leia paces. The Chandrillan's sun burns a bright line around her drawn shades. In the center of the room sits a blue glass hollow platform. It remains quiet. She comes here every day at the same time, waiting for a transmission. She should have heard from Han by now. He's days past their scheduled talk, and the platform flickers to life.
Leia?
Says a shimmering hologram as it resolves from erratic voxels into the form of her husband. Han, she says, stepping close into transmission range. I miss you.
I miss you too.
The way he says it, though, something's wrong. There's a dark edge to his voice. In it, she senses desperation. No, not just that. Anger lurks there too. The anger isn't pointed at her. Even from here, her feelings reach out and find him, and she senses an anger turning inward, like a knife twisted toward one's own belly. He's mad at himself. She knows what he's about to tell her.
I still haven't found him,
Han says. Chewbacca is missing. 2 months back, Han told her that he had a shot to do what the New Republic wouldn't. Liberate Chewie's home planet of Kashyyyk from the chains of the Empire. She told him to wait, to think about it. But he said the time was now, and that an old smuggler had info. A woman named Imra, whom Leia told him not to trust. Turns out, she was right. You still in the Outer Rim? Leia asks.
Edges of wild space. I have a few leads, but it's not looking good.
She pleads with him. Come home, Han. I'm working on the Senate. If we can get them to vote, we can push on Kashyyyk, and maybe find Chewbacca and the others in the process. Testimony from a general like yourself will help to sway them.
It didn't sway them before.
So we try again. The hologram shakes its head.
That's not who I am. I'm not a general. I'm just some pirate.
Don't say that. Everyone here knows how you led the Alliance team on Endor. They know you as a general, not as a...
Leia, I resigned my commission.
What?
I have to do this my way. This is on me, Leia. I have my job to do, and you have yours. You take care of the Republic. I'll find Chewie.
No, no, no. Don't you do this. I'll come to you. Tell me where you are. Tell me what you need. A slow, sad smile spreads across the face of his flickering transmission.
Leia, they need you there. I need you there, too. I'll be all right. I'll find Chewie, and then I'll come home.
You promise? But the hologram suddenly shakes. Han turns his head sharply, as if surprised. Han? She calls.
Son of a...
He starts to say, but the image flickers again.
Under attack!
But the words break up, and then the image dissolves, and he's gone. She feels her middle clench up. No! Again, Leia paces, hoping he'll come back. Hoping that the interrupted transmission returns again, and he tells her it was all a false alarm. She waits for minutes, then for hours, and then until night falls. The hollow platform remains dead. Her husband is out there. She doesn't know where. And he's in trouble. She has to find him. Good thing is, she knows just who to ask.
Chapter 2. The grav raft slides through the mist. Alongside stand massive stone spires, black as night and straight as spears. Vigilant sentinels, their tips are carved to look like howling faces.
Below, far below, glow rivers of swimmy green light, the glowing fungus of Vorlag's cavernous interior. Jom Borel reaches out, grabbing a chain and pulling the raft along, hand over hand. These chains sit moored to octagonal eye bolts jutting out of each spire, connecting each of those dark sentinels to the next. The raft has no engines of its own, and so its motion through the mist is nearly silent, except for the faint throb of its hover paddles.
I don't like this,
Jom says, his voice low.
What's to like? Singe Rath Velas asks, lying back across the flat of the raft, his arms crossed in front of him.
The mist is cold, the day is terrible, I'm sober as a protocol droid.
He sits up suddenly.
Did you know the Death Star had a bar? Ugly, austere little place. Really like all Imperial architecture. Ugh. And the selection of spirits was hardly commendable. But if you knew Pilkey, the drinkslinger, he would give you some of his special batch.
Nora Wexley interrupts him.
Everything is fine. Everything is going according to plan.
The essence of the plan is the same as it always is. Sneak in, capture their Imperial prey, bring him to justice on Chandrilla. Of course, normally they're not sneaking into the mountaintop fortress of a galactic slaver to do it.
Oh, yes,
Jom answers in a sarcastic growl.
It's the idiot's array right here, isn't it? Our girl in there better be doing her job.
She's not our girl, Singier says, snapping back. She's not even a girl, Borel. Jazz is her own woman, and the kind who would gladly kick your tail off this raft for sprinkling your mustache dander everywhere.
What she is a bounty hunter.
Jom grunts as he pulls the raft forward to the next stone pillar.
And I don't trust bounty hunters.
Unconsciously, his hand moves to his bushy mustache, which he quickly smooths down over his scowling mouth.
Yes, we know. We also know that you don't trust ex-Imperials. We know that because you tell us. Constantly.
Jom turns his shoulder and sneers.
Should I trust you?
After all this time, you could start.
Maybe you don't understand what the Empire meant to people like me, and why the Rebellion...
Nora again cuts them off.
We get it, Jom. We're all on this boat together. In this case, literally.
Look. She points. To their starboard, a massive shape emerges from the mist above them. A black, mountainous shadow. The contours of a palace, spiraling towers, and bulbous parapets. If they keep following the chain bolted to the rocks, they'll begin to lift as they pull up, up, up to the front gates of this massive compound carved out of the top of a dormant volcano. It's the home of Slusson Kanker, a.k.a. Kanker the Red, a.k.a. his venomous grace, keeper of men, and killer of foes, the prince and first son of Vorlag, Master Sion Slusson Erlafer Cal Keithan Waugh Kanker. Murderer. Slaver. Scum froth. He's not their target. Their target is an ex-Imperial Vice Admiral, a man named Perwin Geddi. He fled the Empire, absconding with a considerable bucket of credits, enough to keep him fat and happy, and firmly ensconced with a crime lord like Slusson Kanker. High on spice. Serviced by slaves. Living the good life. Living the protected life here in a well-defended volcano-top fortress. So well-defended that marching right up to the front gate would be highly inadvisable. The front gate is protected by two slavering Haroth beasts and two phase turrets and a pair of Haroth keeper guards and a portcullis made of crisscrossing lasers. It doesn't matter, because they're not going that way, are they? They're not taking the high road. They're going low. As Jom eases the raft down two more stone pillars, he reaches back with his hand and shows his open palm.
a silent request that Nora refuses to fulfill. Instead, she says,
I can handle this. You don't have to do everything, you know.
She pulls the grappling spike and screws it into the tip of the concussive pistol.
Jom watches her with narrow eyes as she takes aim at the massive rock.
Give the signal, she says.
Sinjir holds up an emergency beacon, the one that came with their ship, the Halo, for use in case it ever crashes. And he gives it three quick pulses. Red light flashes in quick succession. Moments pass. Then, through the mist, three more red flashes in return. These come from the base of the Rock Mountain, underneath the fortress.
Jazz, you glorious spiky-headed freak! Ha ha! Sinjir says, cackling and clapping his hands.
Nora shushes him and fires the grappling spike toward the space where the three flashes lit up the mist. The gun is quiet enough. It barks out a pow sound as it goes off. The cable looped under the raft whizzes and spins as the spike zips through the air. In the distance, pay dirt.
Jom grabs the cable and pulls the raft now in a new direction. Not toward the gates of the fortress, but to its underbelly. Out there should be a breach in the mountain, which their intel marks as Slusson Kanker's Hroth Beast feeding room. The awful things have wings and like to hunt in the air a few times a day. And that is their staging point. The mountain breach is open to the air, with a ledge beneath it, and the Hroth beasts are kept inside by another crackling laser portcullis. Except right now, that portcullis is down, thanks to Jazz, who came here several days ago. The signal pulsing through the darkness is clear. The way is open.
Told you she'd do us right.
Sinjir whispers in Jom's ear. Jom's only reply is a dubious grunt.
The raft eases through the mist. Ahead, the way into the mountain comes more clearly into view. It's like a yawping mouth with stalactite and stalagmite fangs waiting to swallow them up. No red glow, though. The gate is down. The way is truly clear.
Jom pulls the raft over, cinches the cable up, and loops it around one of the rocks. One by one, they step off the raft and into the cavernous space.
The smell hits them hard. Along the wall are metal bins heaped high with dead things. Birds plucked of feathers and missing their heads. Gobbets of rotten meat from who knows what animal. Hoofed legs, quivering offal. Clouds of hungry gnats swarm in the air in the space above.
This must be food for the Hroth beasts, Nora thinks.
Given the red splatters along the dry, rocky ground, she surmises that someone stands here and throws the meat out into the air, and the beasts go flying to catch it.
Sinjir says, I am quite seriously considering throwing up.
That smell, Jom says, making a face. It'd knock a monkey lizard sideways.
He frowns.
Where's Jazz?
She must be farther in, Nora says. Come on.
The plan is simple enough. Jazz Imari snuck in here days before under the auspices of being a bounty hunter looking for work. Which is true enough, and her reputation surely has preceded her by this point. Crime lords attract bounty hunters the same way these piles of carcass meat attract flies. Hunters are hungry for work, and crime bosses are quick to supply it. She opened the gate for them. And now the work begins. They already have a layout of the fortress, thanks to the holocron supplied by, well, stolen from Surat Nuat, the Akiban boss who had been keeping tabs on the connections between Imperials and the criminal underworld in case he one day needed the leverage. They've been mining that data cube for information. It served, in fact, as a springboard to launch their little team. Once they leave the feeding room, an exit that cannot be quick enough for Nora's nasal passages, It should be a short skip down a long tunnel to a lava tube that runs up the length of the fortress.
Of course, the tube also leads down into the belly of this slow, simmering volcano, which means they should be careful not to fall. Climb up to the south tower, wait for Geddy to emerge from or head to his chambers, then bag him, tag him, and drag him. The goal is to get him onto the raft and out of the palace before anybody even notices. Then they'll serve him up to the Republic Tribunal. Justice comes to the Empire, one war criminal at a time. Then Temin will bring in the ship, and hopefully they exit the atmosphere before anyone even knows Geddy is gone. Temin. Her thoughts turn to her son. Poor fatherless boy. He's part of this team, and not a day goes by without her fearing he shouldn't be.
He's too young, she tells herself.
Even though he proves himself every day.
He's too precious, she thinks,
which is more true than the other thing.
Now that she and her son are reunited, she is reminded how vulnerable he is. How vulnerable all of them are.
Dragging him along for the ride seems entirely irresponsible of her as a parent, and yet a greedy, selfish part of her offers the cold reminder that the only other option would be to once more discard him. Leaving Temin behind again would kill her.
But what other choice would she have?
Retire? Give up this life?
Why is that not an option for you? She asks herself.
Now is not the time to ponder it. They have work to do. She heads toward the tunnel. Jom and Sinji are following close behind.
A lightning crackle rises behind them, followed by a red glow. The portcullis is back.
A mesh of lasers crackling against one another. The searing red cuts through the cable mooring the raft to the rock, and it suddenly drifts into the mist.
No! Jom cries out. Ahead of them, the scuff of heels. Figures and forms fill their escape. The fortress guards, thugs of varying size and breed, heads hidden behind rusted faceplates. Four of them stand there, blasters pointed. Jom draws, so does Sinjir. Nora's about to reach for the pistol at her own hip.
A loud throat clearing comes from behind the guards. A Vorlagan steps out. Skin like the cracked char on a piece of fire-cooked meat. Clear fluid separating from between those fissures. Fluid he dabs at with a filthy brown rag. He blinks his three hollow-set eyes. Sluss and canker. His tongue clicks and clucks when he speaks, and his voice is wet and roomy, as if the words must push their way past some kind of bubbling clot.
I see you thought to intrude upon the peace established by his venomous grace, Slossen Canker. Slossen does not like you here. Slossen finds your trespass very rude, in fact.
Nora thinks for a moment that this isn't Slossen. Then, but something Jazz said pings the radar of her memory. The Vorlagans speak in the third person, don't they? Strange habit. Jom keeps his pistol up.
We're not here for you.
We're here for Geddy, Sinjir says. Just toss him our way and we'll stop intruding upon this lovely ordure pile you call a palace.
The Vorlagan gurgles.
Slossen will give you nothing, Geddy.
From around the corner, their target emerges. The Vice Admiral himself. A man also said to have been in charge of one of the Empire's more brutal biological weapons programs, testing various ancient diseases on captive worlds, raining sickness from the battleships above. He is thin everywhere, but for the pale belly pooching out from his unbuttoned and filthy gray shirt. His skin is the sallow and pitted flesh of a spice addict. A man lost to his addiction.
Geddy is not alone.
He yanks someone hard toward him.
It's Jazz.
He has her by the back of the neck, a pistol held to her temple. She wrenches her head away, but he wrenches it right back.
Slesson has captured the bounty hunter. If you do not drop your weapons, Slesson will have your bounty hunter's head perforated by blaster fire, and her brains will go to feed the Hareth beasts.
Sinjir sighs.
Blast it. His pistol clatters to the floor. Nora gently unsnaps her holster and lets it fall. Jom keeps his pistol up.
I don't surrender my weapon. At Spec Forces, we learn that our weapon is who we are. I can no more surrender it than I can surrender my own arm, or my...
The hand moves fast. Sinjir grabs the gun from the top and wrenches it out of Jom's hand, flinging it against the wall.
They've got Jazz, you oaf.
The guards creep into the room and fetch the weapons.
Geddy licks his lips and grins.
You rebel fools, we'll send you to the Empire, and I'll buy myself a full pardon.
Irritated, Jazz pulls away from him and bats the gun from her head.
They think you can stop pointing that at my skull now.
At first, Nora thinks, here's our chance. Jazz is free. But her freedom came easy. Too easy. No fight at all except the irritation on her face. The realization hits her like a wall of wake turbulence.
Jazz betrayed them.
Jazz steps away from Perwin Geddy, her hands tucked casually in her pockets.
Sorry, team,
she says, that last word spoken with a special kind of sarcasm.
Can't change my horns. Can't change my ink. Can't change who I am.
She shrugs.
They offered a better bounty. In fact, this deal is a pretty good one.
She pulls out a data pad and tosses it to Nora. Nora catches it. With trembling fingers, she lights the screen. On it, she spies a bounty. It's their bounty. She sees their faces, her son's face among them.
You conniving little bilge bug,
Burrell seethes.
I trusted you.
No, you didn't,
Jazz says.
And you shouldn't have. I'm going to do very well with this. Not only is Geddy paying me for alerting him to the attempt to capture him, the Vorlagen here is going to pay me a 20% finder's fee.
Slesson said 15.
Well, a girl can try. A 15% finder's fee for your bounty.
Jazz, don't do this! Nora pleads. Sadness crosses Jazz Amari's face.
I'm sorry, but I have bills to pay. Bills that are coming due. And the Republic just isn't keeping me flush.
Then she gives a flip little salute and says,
it was fun while it lasted.
Jazz exits the room. Geddy laughs.
Let's get you into some cages, shall we?
Sinjir is not fond of cages, especially ones that dangle over an open precipice, regardless of whether it's here on Vorlag or back on Akiva in Surat Nuat's dungeon. These cages are boxy things, like caskets stood on their end, hanging from black rock outcroppings not far from the gateway to the Hareth Beast feeding room. Mist gathers. Fungal light crosses beneath them in sharp, bright lines.
Still feeling good about your friend?
Jom calls. His cage hangs from another overhang about 10 meters away.
Still think I should trust her?
I do, Sinjir says, thrusting his chin out defiantly. And that surprises him more than a little. He doesn't trust anyone. And yet here he is, certain as the stars, that this is all part of some secret plan. One the others just don't see.
A little voice tells him it's because he's so very good at reading body language. It's his job to dissect people with but a glance, cutting them down to all their treacherous little atoms. And another competing voice warns him that maybe, just maybe, he missed something about Jazz Imari. But that doubt is drowned in a washtub of his own confidence, and he feels oddly sure about her. So he says as much to them. "She'll get us out of this yet. Wait and see."
Jom grunts. "Keep dreaming, Imperial."
"Whether she's playing us or playing them, we can't count on her to save us," Nora says. Her cage hangs on the other side of Sinjir's, and she wraps her fingers around the iron.
"We have to get out of here ourselves. They're going to sell us to the Empire. We can't let that happen."
"I think we already let that happen,"
Jom grouses. Then he leans forward against the cage, staring out.
"What even is the Empire anymore? Who controls it? Who will pay for us?"
That is a question Sinjir has been asking himself. At first, it surprised him how swiftly the Imperial forces crumbled. Though, over time, it puzzled him less and less. The unity of the Empire existed because all its chains and threads were held fast in a singular grip. The hand of the Emperor. With the Emperor gone, who was to hold it all together? Rumor said Vader had been taken out too. So who then? The Admirals? The Moffs? They were always rats kept in line by the cats. And now, there are no cats. No clear chain of succession was evident. Palpatine had no family of which to speak, at least as far as anyone knew. Vader didn't have family either, and for all Sinjir knows, wasn't even human anymore. And with two Death Stars gone, a significant portion of the Empire's best and brightest were snuffed out too. The New Republic seized that opportunity. The rebellion was gone. And a new government grew swiftly, if clumsily, in its place. That left the Empire scrambling in survival mode. No clear leadership, because, most likely, they were fighting over it. And day by day, the Imperial forces peel away, defeated, destroyed, abandoned, or stolen. Sinjir imagines that the Empire as a whole was not all that different from how he himself was on the forest moon of Endor that fateful day. Dizzied, bloodied, surrounded by bodies. Unsure of where to go next, or what to do, or what by all the stars even to believe in anymore. A crisis of faith and purpose. That's what it is. Sinjir still suffers his crisis. The New Republic has not been an answer. This team has been an answer, somewhat, though now with his friend's betrayal, he feels back on the edge of things. The question of faith and purpose is left hanging, and no answer is easily seen. The Empire will need its answer, too, and if it doesn't find one in time, it will be destroyed. Deservedly, he decides.
"I need a drink,"
he also decides. Not far away, the familiar buzz of the laser gate suddenly goes silent, leaving everything eerily quiet. But only for a few moments. Soon, a new sound arises. Chuffing snorts and moist gibbers. Out of the yawning mountainside opening, gobbets of meat launch out into the mist. Hroth beasts follow fast. Red, leathery creatures with long wings and a dozen legs leap into the void, chasing the fallen offal, ducking and diving. Their faces are hardly faces at all, just squirming eyeless piles of polyps and tubules. A fleshy mass that looks more like fungus and less like anything you'd find attached to an animal. Out there, a trio of the things swoop and roll, catching meat thrown to them. And then soon, the meat stops. But nobody brings the beasts back inside. The Hroth beasts soar higher.
Still hungry, maybe?
Or worse, Sinjir thinks.
They're bored. And we may make very good playthings.
As if on cue, one swoops down right towards Sinjir's cage, and it slams into it with the weight of a flung vaporator. The beast clings to the side of the cage, pressing its tentacular mess through the grate. Sinjir has just enough room to stab out with his foot, and the tendrils grab his boot and suck it right off his foot. The beast makes greedy nursing noises as it tries to eat the boot. Oh, disgruntled, the creature mewls and gurgles, flinging its head to the side. The boot sails into the vapor. Jom yells through cupped hands,
"Don't let it touch you! Those things on its face are full of stingers! You'll go numb!"
"Blast!" Sinjir presses himself against the back of the cage as the thing probes and bangs its head and foreclaws against the metal. As its teeming masses of tendrils push through the grates like worms, Sinjir spies something shiny under its neck. Something hanging there by a chain. It looks like a key. A dark metal octagonal key. Just like the one used to lock them in here in the first place. Well, that's curious. Suddenly, the creature flies away, sailing once more into the mist. No, no, no! That key! Certainly Slusson's men didn't put it there, did they? They don't seem smart enough for such cruel games. Which means the key is secret, but intentional. Which means the key is from someone who wants them free. Jazz! Sinjir whispers under his breath, suddenly giddy. It's just like in Surat Nuat's dungeon. Him trapped, and her acting as the one to free him yet again. An oddly comforting pattern, that. A classic move! Sinjir moves to the front of the cage and presses his hands through the tight spaces. His arms will fit through up to the elbow, and he waves his appendages around like an animal in distress. "Hey! Hey, you flying sacks of slime! Here! Here! Don't I look delicious? Don't I look like a tasty..." The same one swoops up from below, unseen. Tubules gather around his left arm, and it's like being electrocuted. The limb tingles at first, and then suddenly feels like a thousand little pins are pricking it all at once. Sinjir screams, but maintains. With his free hand, he darts out and snatches the key from around the thing's neck with pinching fingers, then wrenches his hand out of that writhing mass of tentacles. Whining through gritted teeth, he quickly peels back the now ragged tatters of his sleeve. The arm is red, blistering, swelling up, and, as Jom predicted, totally numb. He shakes it, trying to urge feeling back into the limb. Sinjir resists the desire to immediately unlock the cage and, well, then what exactly? Leap into the void? Jump onto one of these things and try to ride it? Those sound like very good ways to die, and Sinjir is all about not dying. He's not entirely sure what he's living for, not yet, but not dying is a very fine start. He whispers to himself, "Patience, old boy. Patience." He waits. The beasts harass Nora and Jom, too, slamming into the cages, the metal banging against the mountainside behind them. Sinjir wants to yell to the others to check for keys, but Slusson's guards, the beast keepers, could be listening. Eventually, the Hroth beasts tire of trying to eat the wriggling meat inside the unyielding metal exoskeletons, and soon the beastkeepers offer a shrill whistle. The beasts leap and swoop back into the cave from whence they came. And then, the familiar buzz of the laser gate returns. Now is the time. Sinjir thrusts his one good arm outside the cage, the key held firm in his grip. It takes a bit of fumbling, but he manages to spin the
key around and get it in the lock. A quick turn, and the door springs open.
Its hinges squeak as the cage hangs in open air. Now what?
He says, clearing his throat.
Some help here?
Jom and Nora both turn, mouths agape.
Is your cage open?
Jom asks.
Obviously it is,
Sinjir snarks.
It's not exactly a hallucination.
Under his breath, he adds.
I hope.
How?
Nora asks.
A key. Jazz left me a key, wound around the neck of one of those awful flying things. It was helpful, but...
He leans out of the cage, holding on with his one good arm. The other remains without any feeling at all. That limb hangs at his side like a broken branch, still dangling from its tree.
Well, let's just say my next steps are a bit up in the air.
We don't know it was her, Jom barks. Could have been one of the slaves. They have a vested interest in getting free.
Yes, Sinjir thinks. But that's not precisely our task here, is it?
Perhaps it should be, but it's not. Plucking the key from the lock, he places it between his teeth and bites down hard. Then Sinjir reaches up and grabs the top of the cage. He uses the bands of the metal cage like ladder steps and clambers to the top.
The cage swings beneath him, and he almost loses his footing. But he reaches up and balances himself against the rock from which the cage dangles.
Up above that rock is a ledge just narrow enough for one. That ledge is how they got down here in the first place. Two of Slusson's guards shimmied the cage along, hooked it to the chain, then dropped it down. A plunging fall that, for Sinjir at least, resulted in the feeling of his teeth cracking together and his innards launching up into his throat.
Breathe in, breathe out.
Imperial fitness mandates kept him in pretty good shape. But after going AWOL, he admittedly let himself go a bit. Got a bit thinner, let his muscles go slack. And it's not like the New Republic demands much. They've no regimen in place. They don't have much in place yet.
You can do it,
Nora says. Ever the cheerleader, ever the group's collective mother. Funny thing is, it works. He believes her.
I can do this.
He reaches up to the rock above and palms around until he finds a viable handhold.
There!
Oh, he swings his dead arm up just in case it somehow stirs the damn thing to life. But it's for naught. Upside, feeling is coming back into that arm. Downside, that feeling is a fiery, prickling pain. He must do it with the one arm, then.
Sinjir pulls himself up, feet scrambling fruitlessly against the chain. Already his arm aches. It burns at the socket, feeling like the whole thing is going to rip out.
Like he's a doll being played with by an overenthusiastic child.
And then, half his torso is up. He shimmies his way up, panting. The ledge isn't far. It only requires a step up.
Easy enough for one with long limbs such as he.
Come on, come on,
Jom growls.
If Sinjir weren't gasping for air with a key locked between his teeth, he'd say, sash me again, you gruff thug, and I'll leave you here for the Empire.
Instead, he manages to offer up a three-fingered gesture that he has been assured is offensive on many Outer Rim worlds. Something about one's mother and a gravity well. To spite Jom, and because it's sensible, he goes to free Nora first. Sinjir creeps along and reaches down, letting the key dangle in his hand.
Nora reaches up and grabs it.
In a few minutes, she's got her cage open, and she's up on the ledge with Sinjir. Then it's Jom's turn. And soon, Sinjir's least favorite person in all the galaxy is also free, joining them on the ledge.
Now what?
Sinjir asks, idly poking at his less numb, now hurting arm.
If I recall, there is a crisscrossing laser portcullis that is quite likely to turn us all into bloody cubes.
Jom thinks.
Look. Come here, look.
He gets to the edge of the ledge, which takes them right up to the border of the crackling gate.
Usually these things are a closed-loop system. The beams emerge from these emitters.
He points at the rusted emitters bolted to the dark mountainside. They look like the tips of blasters, almost.
I need a rock!
Nora searches around, finds one by her feet. Here!
Jom palms it, reaches out, and bashes it against the emitter.
Nothing happens.
He hits it again, and again,
and then really seems to put his all into it, roaring as he slams the rock down. And then, the rock rebounds out of his hand, and plummets into nowhere.
It seems like he's failed.
Sinjir sighs, and both he and Nora start looking around for another rock, finding none.
But then, the emitter suddenly sparks and swings loose, hanging by one bolt. The laser beam fizzles and goes dead.
And like that, the way is clear. One by one, they make their way back into the only room of the fortress they've managed to see. The Haroth Beast feeding room. The stink again assaults them. Sinjir tries very hard not to heave.
So now what?
He says, his voice nasal as he smashes his own nose flat with the back of his good hand.
Do we have a plan? Jazz is still here somewhere, and that means...
It means nothing, John says. We don't know it was her. So we do what the plan always entailed. We go up the lava tube, get Geddy, and...
I can't go up that tube. My arm is dead. I'm tired.
You need to be in better shape, Rathvelis.
I'm sorry. Do we or do we not live in a universe where I just saved your brutish mug? Because, oh, I'm sorry. I assumed you would be kissing my one uncovered foot right now, and yet here you are giving me grief.
Nora steps in between them. Sinjir, you hunt around for a calm. They took ours, so we don't have any way to call Temin or Jazz or, well, anybody. We'll come back this way, and...
From outside the room, voices and footsteps. Jom says,
We got incoming, and we don't have any weapons.
With the voices comes another familiar sound.
Grunts, barks, gibbers... Haroth beasts. Damn! The animals are followed by Slusson's guards, drawn here presumably by the noise. Maybe they somehow learned the gate was down. Either way, they come hard charging in, blasters up, Haroth beasts on long leather leashes. Their tendrils search the air. But Nora thinks fast, and moves fast too. She's already over by the bins of rotting meat. And Sinjir watches in awe and disgust as she starts throwing it. One by one, she pelts the guards with rotten meat. Their blaster fire going astray as rancid flesh hits them in the face, chest, and arms. The stink of the meat is too tantalizing to resist. Brilliant, Sinjir thinks as the beasts turn on their owners. The monsters attack, slathering their screaming keepers with their wet tendrils in a desperate search for gobbets of rank meat.
Move!
Jom calls, and they hurry past the scene of carnage. The lava tube is tight, but not so tight they don't have a little room to move. The tube itself is ridged and scalloped, giving them handholds and toeholds as they climb.
Nora and Jom easily brace themselves and shimmy up the long channel, slowly but surely. Below them, far down, glows a pinprick of bright orange light.
Don't fall, don't fall, don't fall, she repeats to herself like a mantra.
That fall would not be a pleasant one. A slide down the porous volcanic stone would scrape half her skin off just in time for her to plunge into a searing hot magma bath, cooking her raw, scorching her dead. These tubes are how Slusson heats his fortress, it seems. The air coming up is like hot breath from a hellish monster. Sometimes they find adjacent tubes branching off at perpendicular angles, and when they pass, they hear the sounds of distress going through Slusson Kanker's palace. Voices raised, an alarm called.
We don't have long. Up, up, up. Her arms and legs aching.
Jom telling her to keep moving. She wants to tell him,
I'm not cut out for this.
But she has to be. It's too late to be anything else. And so she pushes. And when her hands finally reach the lip of the last branching tube, it feels like forever has passed.
She pulls herself up and slides out,
stone abrading her stomach as she lands in a lavish and hideous room, panting. Nora looks up. Black walls are decorated with gaudy golds and borzite mirrors. A statue of Slusson stands in the corner, carved out of fire-red quartz crystal. The bed is octagonal, like the key that unlocked their cages, and it's piled with animal skins and pillows of red leather. Such wealth is alien to Nora. And in a place like this, it has clearly gone to waste.
Good. You're here.
Nora's heart about hops out of her throat as she hears Jazz's voice from the corner of the room, out of sight. She turns and sees the bounty hunter sitting there in a high-backed chair, legs crossed, arms crossed, and one Imperial Vice Admiral lying at her feet. Geddy's hands are bound behind him with wire. His mouth is gagged with what looks to be a pillowcase, wadded and rolled and knotted behind his head. From the lava tube, Jom emerges. He instantly sees the Zabrak, and once on his feet, marches toward her, growling in rage.
You almost got us killed.
I got us all saved and paid, and I'm getting the job done. We can talk about this later.
She grabs the comm at her belt and speaks into it.
Timon, we need an extraction. Still in the tower. You'll know the sign.
When she puts the comm back on her hip, she asks,
Where's Sinjir?
Downstairs looking for a comm,
Nora says. Jazz makes a face like that personally wounds her.
That is a complication. I'll go find him and meet you at the feeding room.
From outside the room, the rumble of footsteps. The door to this chamber is a round, gilded portal sealed with an electrical panel. A panel that has been torn out. Its wire is dangling and still sparking. Someone pounds on the door. From the other side, a muffled voice.
Slusson wants to know, is Geddy in there?
Geddy doesn't even seem to hear. His eyes are bloodshot. The pupils are big and fat, and he doesn't even blink. From behind his gag, the Imperial makes faint cooing and gurgling noises. Nora realizes he's high. Nearby sits a small tin, once again octagonal in shape, of dark spice. From the other side of the door,
Slusson commands this door to open!
The whine of a drill rises.
They're going to take the door off. How are we getting out of here?
Nora asks.
The tube?
It's the way I'm going,
Jazz says.
But the two of you are going out that way.
When she says that way, she points to the massive bow window at the far side of the room. Nora is about to protest, but to her surprise, Burrell says,
I like that. Let's get it open.
Jazz says,
The halo should be incoming. See you soon.
And without further word, she slips back down the lava tube. Burrell and Nora head to the window. Jom feels along, looking for hinges, a latch, something, anything. Nora tells him she can't find any, and he agrees. And then he goes to pick up the chair Jazz had been sitting in only moments before. Without further comment, he flings it through the window. The chair punches a hole through the glass, then is gone. He kicks out the rest of the glass, framing it with his boot. Out there, above the fog, and near the peaks of other dark mountains, Nora spies a ship. An SS-54 gunship.
The Halo. Temin. Tell Vice Admiral Getty his ride has arrived,
Nora says. Then she makes the mistake of looking down. Vertigo assails her.
And tell him I hope he's not afraid of heights.
The Halo bangs and rattles as it skips across the mists of Warlag. The ion engines on each side are spun horizontal, screaming loud as the gunship, classified by its manufacturer, Vodachev Shipyards, as a light freighter in order to avoid regulations, punches forward. Ahead, the volcanic fortress of Slussen Canker rises out of the fog. Its bent and twisting towers like charred fingers reaching for the heavens as if to pull them down. Temin sits at the controls. The flight sticks pushed all the way forward. This ship isn't as fast as an X-Wing, but it has power, especially given the modifications that Temin made to the engines. The thing moves with weight and purpose, and it has his blood pounding in his temples like a Kievan drums. He cracks his knuckles and snaps his fingers, a nervous habit picked up from his father.
You ready?
He asks his co-pilot.
Roger, roger,
chimes the B-1 battle droid. Mr. Bones, a bodyguard and pal who has seen more than a few special modifications all his own. The droid, painted in red and black, has the cut of a human skeleton topped with the skull of a rock vulture. And Temin has only worked to make the droid more intimidating as time has gone on. Jagged metal cut out of the front to look like teeth. Hands sharpened into claws. His frame now features half a dozen extra joints to allow the droid a degree of contortion unseen in the already collapsible B-1s. Gone are the little bones that decorated him. Their mission these days necessitates stealth. And Jazz said the wind chime rattle of those bits would be a problem. Temin was reluctant, but he listened. He likes Jazz. He trusts her. If she said stealth matters, then stealth matters. Of course, right now, stealth is about 10 clicks back, isn't it?
I am eager to eradicate our adversaries,
Bones says, his voice warped and warbling.
I hope to turn them into a fine red mist. Just say the word, Master Temin.
The droid has his claws wrapped around the gun controls. The Halo packs a wallop. Twin-mounted ZX-7 laser cannons hanging below the well-armed front cockpit. And at the top, a quad cannon rail thrower mounted to a jury-rigged turret. Right now, though, the mission is extraction. Not chewing the landscape apart with weapons fire. So Temin tells his pal to cool down. Bones nods and hums to himself, skull moving in time with the tune.
Here we go, Temin says, and he eases the engines, then pivots them vertical, letting the Halo hover. There he spies the second tallest tower in the fortress, its window busted open. His mother, looking nervous and agitated, waves him forward. He gives an okay, and then slides the gunship sideways so that the access ramp is pointed toward the tower.
Bones, go help! I'll keep it steady!
The droid springs up, does a handspring over the seat, and then whirls out of the cockpit and into the belly of the Halo.
Temin flips the screen to the access cam, and he extends the ramp. The side of the ship peels away and becomes an entry hatch.
Bones helps Nora carry their prisoner on board. Jom takes his own running leap and clears the space easily. But then, something hits the side of the ship, rocking it.
What the...
He glances at the cam again and sees chaos. A shape scrambling against the access ramp. Some kind of creature... Its face is just a sloppy pile of something that looks like soft, searching fingers. Bones pirouettes, his claw snapping back as the concealed vibroblade along the long metal bone of his forearm springs forward. He slices it upward, cutting through the tangle of tendrils before putting the thing out of the ship. two more appear where the first one fell. And then, the halo scanner beeps as something pings it. Four red blips, coming in from aft. He checks the signatures. One Imperial shuttle, and a trio of TIEs. He yells back, "Who invited the Empire to the party?" His mother answers as she sidles into the cockpit. Sluss and Kanker did, and Getty, hoping to buy his way out of whatever punishment awaits an AWOL vice admiral. Then she explains to him where Jazz and Sinjir are.
"We need to go pick them up."
"And if they're not there?"
"Then we wait."
Suddenly there's Jom's head through the door, and he's scowling and sneering, and Temin knows what he's going to say. He's going to say, "We leave them behind. They aren't the mission." Because that's how he is. Everything is the mission. And he sure doesn't like Jazz and Sinjir, does he? So that's why it's a surprise when he says,
"No one left behind."
Temin grins.
"Not even an Imperial and a bounty hunter?"
"Not when it's our Imperial and our bounty hunter. Let's go."
Temin banks the ship away from the fortress. The scanner shows the shuttle and the TIEs incoming fast on his tail. He has an idea. He boosts the ship forward, giving it a hard kick from the engines before putting it back to hover again. His mother protests.
"Temin, don't stop. Keep this ship moving."
"I know what I'm doing,"
he says, spinning the halo around 180 degrees.
"Temin! Temin!"
Ahead, the TIE fighters shriek forward, cutting the air like razors. They start to swoop in low towards Slusson's fortress. Already the air is peppered with laser fire, and the blast popped the front of the halo.
"Now!"
Temin thinks. He takes control of the guns with a flip of a switch, then turns the rail throwers forward and up. His fingers squeeze the triggers. Thin nanofiber rail tubes rattle off, the cannon firing them at hundreds of rounds per second. They chew through the black rock tower. Stone coughs up in chips and splinters. The tower, like a notched tree, begins to fall. And it falls right onto two of the TIE fighters. It takes one out clean, crushing it in midair, leaving nothing left but a burning streak across Temin's vision. The other catches debris against its wing panel, and suddenly the thing spirals downward like a bird with its wings sliced off. John claps the boy on the shoulder.
"Quick thinking, kid. Let's go get our people and get the hell out of here."
"What has my son become?"
That question sticks in Nora's belly like a knife. Her thoughts, her awareness, sit separate from her actions. Almost like she's two different people. Like one of her is the internal version. This sudden bundle of fear and worry. The other is Nora the soldier. Nora the pilot. Nora who retakes control of the weapon system and peppers the fortress with laser fire. Inside, she's a tumult of feelings. All of them fighting for supremacy, like whole planetary systems desperate to dominate one another. Her son is doing exactly what he's supposed to do. He's fighting for the New Republic. The Empire is their enemy. What he did was smart, sharp, and demonstrative of his capability. Meaning that now he is both soldier and pilot too. Is that what she wanted for him? He's young. He's only 15. Though, she's reminded, his birthday is coming up soon. Time moves fast, and it only gets faster when you have children. He just took out two TIE fighters. No, he killed two pilots. Two lives snuffed out. The problem isn't whether they deserved their fates. Those pilots signed up for war and knew what came with it. The problem is what that makes Temin. It haunts her. Suddenly, will it haunt him? Is he too young to even understand what's happening? Will one day he awaken to ghosts in his head? Or will he toughen to it too quickly? Will it kill the kindness inside him and make him mean like John Burrell? These thoughts tear her apart inside, even as she does her duty. Nora operates the guns and fires, even as Temin brings the ship alongside the feeding room entrance, even as she lays down suppressing fire and cuts apart the masked guards who rush up to defend Kanker's empire.
There,
Jop says, placing a hand on her forearm. His voice seems distant. Everything seems distant. Her pulse kicks in her chest, in her neck, in her wrists. Adrenaline eats her up the way those rail throwers gnawed apart the palace tower. She blinks and pushes past all that. In the feeding room, two guards rush up to the edge. But before they can do anything, both of them shudder and pitch face forward into the fog, bodies plunging. Coming up behind them are Jazz and Sinjir. The former has a blaster out and is using her free hand to help support the latter. Sinjir hobbles along, his arm hanging limp at his side. One of the Ties swoops in from above, and Nora quickly turns the rail throwers toward him as Temin slides the halo up to the entryway. A quick burst sends the Tie pivoting back into the sky, momentarily dissuaded. With Jazz and Sinjir back on board, Jom says to the boy,
"Punch it!"
And Nora's blood goes from her brain to her feet as the halo accelerates fast through the atmosphere above Vorlag, the Tie fighter hopping on their trail and following close behind. Chapter 3. Sloane stands in the center of a glowing blue circle and speaks to the galaxy.
"This is Grand Admiral Ray Sloane, commander of the Imperial Navy and de facto leader of the Galactic Empire. The Empire remains vigilant in combating the anarchist criminal government calling itself the New Republic. The dream of a safe, sane, and unified galaxy did not die with the glorious Emperor Palpatine. The Galactic Empire continues to march forward, tirelessly diligent in its quest to return order and stability where none before existed. Meanwhile, the New Republic continues its own mission to destroy what we have built together. Crime has returned to the galaxy tenfold as the underworld dynasties have regained dominance over worlds once kept free of their toxic influences by the Empire. Supply lines have been cut, and many worlds are now starving without adequate food. The corrosive influence of the New Republic has caused a seemingly insurmountable loss of jobs, income, and even lives.
This is the moment, she thinks. Sloane puts steel in her spine, and what was it her new advisor said to her? Bronze in your voice. She continues.
But fear not. The Empire remains as sure as a mountain, as certain as the stars across all the systems. We will defeat the insurgency. We will make this false government pay for its crimes against you. Even now, we are building new ships, new bases, and founding new technologies to keep you safe. The Empire is coming. We will deliver you from harm, and we will strike back against our enemies. Remain calm. Remain loyal. With true hearts, victory for us and for the whole galaxy will soon be at hand.
She gives a curt nod, and the blue glow around her dissipates. The circle goes dark, and for a moment she's left alone in the lightless room, listening to the murmuring sounds and shuffling feet. It is a moment of peace, rare and precious, and she clings to it like a child holding a doll. Then the lights come back on, and once again, her new life resumes. This room is the Office of Imperial Promotion, Galactic Truth, and Fact Correction. Most just call it the OIP. It grew out of the ashes of Compnor to countermand the influence of the New Republic across systems and sectors. Sloane is here a lot, much to her chagrin. Over walks Ferric Obdur with his assistant. Pretty thing, with skin so pale, Sloane can see the dark veins beneath her skin. And they help Sloane down off the projection platform. Obdur is older than she is, an irascible cad with sharp tufts of silver hair coming off his cheeks, jowls, and chin. He's something of a relic of the old days.
Obdur was a young man in the army during the tumultuous shift from the Republic to the Empire.
He helped design the informational assault that soothed the galaxy in its transition. Which is why Ferric Obdur is now the Chief Informational Officer, a role Sloane assigned to him, but not by her own choice. Rather, it was assigned through her. Obdur is smiling, always smiling, a glint in his eyes, like he thinks he knows more than everyone else in the room.
Grand Admiral Sloane, a fine job, if a bit stiff.
I was told to put steel in my spine, so I did.
Of course, of course. You did fine, just fine. Here, over this way. I have some images I need you to look at.
He directs her to a long metal table against the far wall, a table inlaid with lights that he flicks on. He opens a folder and lets a series of translucent pages slide out. The light beneath them makes their colors and inks pop.
These are posters, as you can see. We'll hang them on worlds both safe and contested.
One poster depicts two stormtroopers handing out a basket of fruits to a human family in need. Another shows a small battalion of New Republic troops, portrayed as dirty, unshaven slobs in ill-fitting helmets, pointing flamethrower streams at the front gates of an Imperial Academy. In that image, children are seen at the windows, screaming against the glass. A third image shows another series of scowling Republic soldiers, these with the shadow of a hut slug behind them. Obdur pulls that one toward him.
I don't much care for this. Too subtle. The goal is, of course, to infer the connection between the rebels and the criminal organizations. But we need to do more than infer. We need that connection to be clear, concise. A hard slap to the face. A dose of reality.
Reality, Sloane thinks. What grave irony. None of this is real. And she says as much. Why are we resorting to these